This is the strategy inside everything. I'm Adam Pierno.
All right. Welcome back to another episode of the Strategy Inside Everything. I am really looking forward to this conversation. It took us some time to get it scheduled and finalized, but we're here and we're going to have a great conversation. I can already tell. Today's guest is the CEO of Explain. It is Eric Wood. Eric, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Adam.
I'm really glad we were able to find this time and make it work. Thank you for rolling with the punches as we both had tsunamis hit our calendars.
My pleasure.
And you're just off a flight, so I appreciate you jumping on the phone with me now.
I'm glad we're on tape because that way no one can see the bags under my eyes. But yeah, I didn't leave last night, but excited to talk to you this morning.
Well, it's theater of the mind, so now they're imagining them. Right. But just to put us on equal footing, I probably have bags under my eyes too. You know, it's been a crazy week. So I want to talk about your excellent book, The Strategy Activation Playbook, and the process and the work behind the book. I mean, the book is almost like a totem for that work. But before we get to the book, I want to have you give people a sense of your path to CEO at Explain.
Okay. Well, I think it started off with probably five or six beers at Gordon Biersch in San Francisco with Dave Gray, who was the founder of Explain. And at the time, Explain had been established since 1993. We met in about 2003, and I was at Intuit at the time, doing new business development, product management, looking for new opportunities to help support Intuit customers. So either building or buying new products where there are unmet needs. And Dave was on my research list because we were working on an e-learning business. And I really got excited about the idea of visual learning, the idea that people can understand information much more quickly. They can grasp complexity much more quickly using combinations of words and pictures rather than just reading a statement. And so I wanted to meet with Dave to learn a little bit about his thinking about visual thinking and how it could apply to learning and how people can adapt information more quickly. And he proceeded to buy a few beers. And after a long conversation, he said, you know, I'd really like you to come over to Explain and actually help me grow this. And so that's how the relationship started.
Was that your intent or was it just,
no.
You just hit it off and the beer was that good?
I never thought after a career in software and management consulting that I was going to go, you know, back to a small consulting firm and do that. But that's just kind of how it worked out. And I was excited about the opportunity because actually it gave me an opportunity to kind of merge a couple of observations in my life. I've always kind of lived at the intersection of business and design. Mm-hmm. I have a formal business background, you know, MBA, management consulting experience, but also have always worked at the intersection of the new. How do we create something new? How do we envision something new? How do we create a new product? How do we launch a new product? What are those unmet needs? And so it was an interesting opportunity to actually bring those things together. And with Explain, which was very much a hybrid of a design firm and a management consulting firm, I found a home where I could work at the intersection of business and design and do really cool stuff.
How do you balance those two elements, the design and the consulting? Because they sometimes are very simpatico and sometimes they are at odds, if not corralled in the correct way.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's interesting because I, prior to working in software and internet, I was at Bain & Company as a consultant for a short period of time. And, you know, I loved working in that environment where just incredibly brilliant people around and they're really doing great work. But it's also frustrating because when you're actually working inside of an organization, there's a lot of creativity, a lot of insights. And there wasn't really the opportunity in the traditional consulting role to co-create.
Co-create how to capture the most creative elements of those insights, you know, or how to bring, you know, it's more like, yeah, but get to the therefore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, sort of lead with the answer first. Here's the report, throw it over the wall. This isn't a critique necessarily of my former employer. I loved the work we did, but the frustration I observed was a lot of times in terms of really making change, you've got to work with the people that are going to be responsible and accountable for the change very closely so they can get their fingerprints on the work and they can feel a sense of ownership of it. Yep. And so what was really intriguing about merging design and consulting was that design by its very nature is a discovery-based art. It's a process of going in, observing, learning, gathering insights, and then iteratively designing or co-creating solutions. And it was a really different way to work. And it was a way to work that really resulted in stickier solutions, things that were both probably better ideas because they were more integrated with the insights of the organization, but also that it wasn't ours, it was theirs. You know, people created it themselves.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really, you know, an interesting trend we're seeing generally in the consulting space is really this question of the old way of throwing it over the wall versus the new way of really co-creating at the side of your customers or your partners.
Yeah.
That's a real differentiator.
People support what they help build.
Ah, I read that somewhere.
Yeah. So it's funny that having just done been the client on a few consulting projects over the past couple of years, getting the PowerPoint deck is like, okay, cool. You just gave me X amount of thousands of dollars to-do list that I have to go now execute. And now I have to explain it to all these people that have to do it.
Yep.
That's quite a feeling for the manager that gets that assignment.
Absolutely. Here's your 150 page PowerPoint. Now go stand up at the town hall meeting and tell everyone where we're going.
Yeah. The consultants that aren't here right now told me to tell you guys this. Here we go. Oh God. Well, what types of clients are you working on mostly, or more importantly, I think, were you working on as you were working through the strategy activation playbook?
So this book is built on probably almost 30 years of kind of our collective wisdom. So, I got to put the pen to the paper, but I got to tell you, there are just an incredible number of people that really contributed to the work, and including our clients and partners. By and large, much of what comes through in this book is coming from the experience of working in large organizations, Fortune 500 companies, global organizations, places where there's a lot of complexity. And the reason that that's a really interesting place to study this work is that it's one of the places that's the hardest to get things done. You know, you're not only trying to shift an entire organization, but you're shifting an entire organization in multiple time zones, multiple cultures, multiple languages, yes, different ways of working. So it was a great test bed for learning for us and for our clients. And then being able to sort of cross-pollinate what we learn in each place and take them to other places really started to build the body of what we tried to share here.
I usually will not talk to an author about their book until I've read the book, although I'm guilty of on occasion skimming it. In your case, I've read the entire book twice.
Wow.
And what I like about it very much is similar to my first book, Under Think It. It is a playbook that I could keep on my desk and circle things and come back to it. And if I'm stuck, I can flip. I feel like I'm going to be using this book to find answers when I'm stuck or new ways to think about it. It is very, it presents a methodology, but you can kind of jump in anywhere just to dislodge. Oh yeah. Right. Okay. I'm stuck here. And here's a new way to shift my thinking about, or I could bring these people in, or I should be thinking about the future state and not be so stuck in where I am right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you even start writing it? Because it's almost broken to two halves. If the way I read it, you know, the first half is like, here's what I'm going to tell you and here's why. And then the back half really is a playbook of step-by-step. This is how it works. How did you attack this book?
I love your characterization, and I'm honored you read it twice, and you've definitely nailed it, because what you've described is exactly what our intent was. Our intent was, and we use the word playbook very mindfully to say, I don't want a book that's just going to sit on a shelf. I want something that's going to be a tool,
yeah,
you know, something that people can actually put on their desk and draw from and use on a regular basis. And so it was really designed to be pragmatic. It was designed to really help change makers that are making change in the world do it better, do it faster, do it more effectively. So we did approach it very specifically to say, okay, there's a certain amount of setup we need to do. We need to share a couple of our points of view in the front matter and start to explain why we think traditional change management doesn't work, why we think organizations get stuck, why strategies fail. And then with that context set, because it is a philosophical shift from where we've come from, then introduce, okay, here's the antidote. Here's a set of tools. Here's a toolkit that you can use and draw on. And it's not a process like a lot of change management.
Yes. And, you know, I think I may have buried the lead here, because for the listeners of this particular show, so much of what we do is that PowerPoint that gets shared in a meeting, and it's a big meeting and everybody gets excited and you leave and you feel great. And then nobody does anything with it, or you're not sure what to do about it. So let's actually talk. You mentioned, you know, why do strategies fail? Let's talk about that. You know, there's some great background on that in the book.
Yeah.
Why is that a recurring theme? Why does strategy hit the wall?
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, there's been a lot of people that have studied this. Universities, Kaplan's books covers this topic. There's a bunch of information out there, and everyone kind of comes to the same conclusion, which is about 80% of major strategy transformations fail.
Yeah.
Which, when you think about the amount of money that's spent and the amount of resources that are invested, like, that's just an immense, immense failure rate. And so we started looking at it and trying to understand what is it we're seeing with our clients that are struggling, and where are we seeing successes, and what are the bright spots, and what's consistent with that? Mm-hmm. Assuming the strategy is good, right? There's a bunch of other things. Assuming the strategy itself is good.
Which is 50-50.
Which is 50-50, right? But it's like advertising, which half works. But if we take out all those other factors, market factors, whether the strategy is good or not, and we just look at the people side of the coin, we see a couple things that are typical. The first one, the biggest one is this sort of what we call line of sight problem. We don't actually help connect people, individuals in the organization, to the big picture, right? We might paint the picture of this is our strategy, but it doesn't really mean anything to me. And I don't really understand my role. Yep. And how my role ladders up to actually creating change in the organization and how I fit side by side with my peers. So we talk about the need to really paint that picture clearly for folks, to go beyond that 100-page PowerPoint deck, you know, launch it at the town hall meeting and walk away and really get under the hood of how do we help people see why what they're doing is important in this big picture.
Yeah, and how it connects.
Yeah, how it connects. The second one that we call out is, you know, this idea of employee engagement. You know, so again, back to that idea that you just, you know, shared. CEO comes in, says, we've got a new strategy. We just worked with this top tier consultant. I'm going to take you through this 50-page deck. And it's announced, and it's kind of a launch, and then nothing behind that, right? We're not engaging employees in feedback. We're not engaging them perhaps even in the process of making that strategy in the first place. And we're not investing a lot of time downstream to actually help them help us figure out how to execute it. So that employee engagement factor ends up, if it doesn't happen, making it feel like this thing's just thrown over the wall. Mm-hmm. And employees, you know, that isn't a great way to support adoption. And then, you know, the last thing is, and really it's the subject of this book, when all is said and done, we spend a ton of money on strategy making, but we don't spend much money or resources in terms of saying, okay, how are we going to make this stick? How do we, just like a marketing campaign, plan a series, a cadence of touch points with our employees to help make sure that they're hearing it, that they're understanding it. Maybe we're supporting their growth and helping them learn new skills so they can execute it, measuring the progress along the way, reinforcing them, right? All the stuff that it takes for humans to actually learn to do something new. We need to make that investment.
Yeah, that area is not a strength of mine. And so I'm always really quick to be like, somebody figure that part out, but I can't do it. but it is really the detail you go into and the level of explaining, like, why the relationships among the teams and the interrelationship between teams with other teams and managers with staff and how it all has to work together. It was really helpful for me to read it and be like, all right, okay, now I understand. Like, I think intuitively we understand it's important to support the teams and let them see how it all connects.
Yeah.
But that really making it real and the way you lay it out in the playbook was helpful for me.
Well, thanks. You know, and I just want to add one thing there. We were talking before we started this interview about marketing, right? And you know, what it takes to actually market an idea and to build an idea and actually have it, you know, set in someone's mind over time. This is the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. We, you know, strategy activation is really, how do we start to weave a consistent narrative and story about where we're going and how we're going to get there?
Yeah.
And then you can't just say it once. You need to actually build a marketing campaign. And that, yes, marketing campaign has to be multifaceted, because ultimately we're trying to get thousands of human beings to all move forward in the same direction.
Yeah. And each of them to understand how it impacts them. It's like, what's the reason to believe for them to be doing, to changing the way they work, to activate this thing that they weren't a part of necessarily.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's huge. I've dog-eared a bunch of pages. And what I'm going to do is just start flipping through and find those dog ears. I probably have 10. We probably won't do them all.
All right.
But the first one I dog-eared, I actually came back the second time I read it. I put a double dog ear. Look at this.
Double dog ear.
Wow. Yeah. Come on. That's serious.
What page is this? I got to look.
It's page 88. It's about the anticipation of system impacts.
Oh, yeah.
And it's looking at unforeseen impacts, and you lay out 8 dimensions. Please don't list the 8 dimensions. I don't think that matters, but the idea, the complexity and a model for how you can forecast that and how you can really just think through it in a simple way. Because a lot of times we say, well, yeah, something will happen that we haven't anticipated, but we have to move forward. It's like, yeah, but what if we just did try to think through a little bit?
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit about that. And I wonder if there's not a story or two behind maybe lessons learned on how you got to this.
Yeah, there is. You know, it's so the idea that you're referring to in the book, we have a framework we call 8 dimensions of the arc. It's just a framework you can use. But the idea is simply this. It's like a balloon. If you make a change in an organization, if you press that balloon, that air's got to go somewhere and it's going to probably pop out someplace else. And there's probably an unexpected impact. And so when you make a change in an organization, if you're trying to drive a transformation of some kind, one of the things that oftentimes torpedoes those transformations is maybe the thing you didn't expect. It's okay. As an example, I'm working with a health sciences company that's trying to shift their sales teams to be more consultative rather than transactive. Mm-hmm. Right? And we want to get them to be working with their clients more actively and engage them in new ways, more customer centric ways, engage them in the process. And we want them to stop thinking about the transaction. But in the process of rolling that change out, maybe they don't change the incentive plan, right? Maybe their incentives are still lined up the old way. You've now got a conflict there, because it isn't that the strategy's wrong. It's that you didn't think about the entire organization and what are all the other impacts that are influencing that person's decision making.
Right. You changed their SOP, but you didn't change their incentive plan. So they're never going to follow the new SOP if they get bonused on the old one.
Right. Exactly. And, yeah. You know, there's lots of other examples that we look at, but you know, whether it's looking at culture, whether it's looking at systems and processes, whether it's looking at supporting technology, one of the things we encourage people to do is to try to, you know, use design research in your work before you actually build your change program to anticipate all of the barriers to change. You know, why let those things stop and stall your progress? If you can do some amount of research up front, understand and anticipate, if I make this change in the organization, where are the things that are going to potentially stall it, and then mitigate that earlier. And so this is where sort of design comes into the work. Because a lot of, you know, what we talk about in this book is the importance of that discovery phase to really go into the organization and uncover those barriers to change in advance. Because you don't want to get the flat tire when you're on the journey.
how deep into the org is reasonable to do that assessment of, you know, potential impacts? Like if you're working with a leadership team, you're obviously far from the work at that point. And so you might look at that, to your example of the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, well, how do I know what the impact might be for the call center versus the nurses? How deep into the org is it reasonable to go? Is there a equation that you use to figure that out? Because I mean, design thinking is great, but you can take it all the way down to the pixel level, and then it's months and millions of dollars.
Yeah, well, this is where human-centered design comes in. And so the short answer is, we go talk to the humans that are going to mm-hmm. be impacted. It sounds obvious, and almost nobody does it. And so this is a huge opportunity. We might apply, we might identify and sit down with the client and say, okay, let's look at this change now. We don't need to get 100% of the organization on board for this change to be successful, but there's probably 4 or 5 stakeholder groups that are critical to it. You know, we got to get the sales teams buy-in. You know, maybe we've got to get the product engineering folks on board. We maybe got to get so-and-so on board. So we start to talk with folks, with the people leading the strategy, about who are the most impacted groups. And then we go talk to those groups, and we, mm-hmm. you know, just start to have a frank, you know, whether it's a focus group, whether it's a survey, whether it's just a, you know, informational interview. But, you know, they'll tell you where the challenges are. They'll tell you where I'm not clear why we're doing this. I'm not clear how this is going to be implemented. They might say, I'm totally on board with this. However, mm-hmm. I don't have the skills to do it. And is the organization going to give me that training? Those are all clues for us, because those tell us things like, oh, you know, our challenge isn't going to be communicating the idea. Our maybe the resistance is going to be, we need to invest in some learning and development for the team so that they can actually level up to achieve mm-hmm. this goal. And that's
give them, the risk is. Give them the confidence that they will not be replaced. They will be upskilled.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And if we know that in advance, then we don't cause the fear that oftentimes causes people to switch jobs or go to another place or just not engage, which is really the most important issue. We've got a bunch of people that are kind of crossing their arms and saying, well, you know, this is the flavor of the month. Let's let it pass. That transformation is not going to happen.
Yeah. They're just digging their heels in there. That's no good. I think, we don't talk very much about what it takes to be a client of a consultant, but part of the work of being the client, whether it's a team or an individual that takes those meetings and deals with the consultant and watches the decks transform and does the legwork with them, is to make sure that that information is getting shared and make sure it's getting pinged to different people and different groups during the process. Mm-hmm. So where I've seen it fail is, you know, the consultants deliver their final, the executive team all loves it. And then it's 6 months of, okay, well, now I have to take this deck from them and transform it into our language and start shopping it. And only then you're getting the battle testing that you need.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, cool. I had an army of people doing research for me and now they're all paid and gone. Now I'm stuck.
Yeah.
There should be a certificate for how to hire a consultant. It seems like something that would be very needed in a lot of complicated organizations.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that we've sort of observed that really works well there, and particularly if you're a consultant and you're thinking about how to do this work and avoid that surprise is, you know, this is another place where sort of co-creation along the route, along the journey and encouraging people that this is an iterative design is a real thing. You know, I remember the days where, you know, you couldn't go and talk to a client unless the deck was perfect. You know, everything was dotted. It had been proofread. It was idealistic. It was just beautiful. And the answer was there, right? And the challenge with that is that doesn't leave room for dialogue, for exploration, for learning. It doesn't also allow room for feedback. And so one sort of like hot tip that we share all the time is we try to visualize all of the ideas along the route. You know, if you can paint it, if you can draw a one page picture of your vision of where you're going, but leave it rough, right? Just draw it out, sketch it out, and then go to those stakeholders we're talking about and say, hey, what do you think? You know, what resonates? What doesn't resonate? How can you help me make it better? That page, as that moves through the organization, gets better and better and better. And all of a sudden, all those people that were engaged in that process have contributed to it, are enthusiastic about it, and they're now internal ambassadors. We're helping to share it from within. So you've started to also create the movement and the process of making the answer.
Yeah. And so part of what you're taught, so the book is full of those kind of map frameworks that for each step, there's a different kind of map. I mean, I don't think every step has a map, but there's a lot of tools for sketching ideas and tools for sketching the intended outcomes in progress, which I think are really valuable. So I'm looking at the vision map at the moment. And I think what you're describing is a great way to engage those people at the super earliest stage in a way that makes them not only have ownership of it, but turns it from a binary yes or no, which is what the old model did. I think of when you see something really polished, you're kind of Siskel and Ebert at that point. It's thumbs up or thumbs down.
Right. Exactly.
But here it's like, no, get your Sharpie out. Let's go. Help me craft this. And if you want to change the shape of the map, I really don't care. You want it to be vertical? Great. Is mm-hmm. that better? Like, we don't care about that part. We just want to get the story straight so it's going to be effective.
Then you're having a what if conversation. What if we did it this way? What if we did it that way? That gets better. And so, yeah, this totally resonates, Adam, because I came back, as I mentioned, I was working with clients yesterday. We're working with a university in Boston where we were doing exactly that just yesterday. They were bringing together a new department, pieces and parts of different departments in the organization. And they were trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? What are we going to build? And we used that exact vision map that you're referring to as the core exercise, where we had every individual in that room draw their picture, their vision of where they thought the organization could go. Then they shared it out. And sort of like that parable of five blind men and an elephant, everybody saw a different part or a different potential. But when all 10 of them shared with one another, we saw a whole picture. And then we iterated that to a common picture of a vision that was holistic and everyone's sort of voice was in it. And by the end of the day, there was a really clear pathway for what was going to get built in 2023.
And that's through the conversation and debate over the various parts of the elephant that each person sketched out.
Yeah. And especially when you make it visual, it's, you know, when you put words on a page or struggle over a vision statement or a mission statement, you know, words are very nuanced. But when you actually draw, and I for your listeners who don't know that I'm serious, you know, we, you know, Explain is very focused on trying to use visual learning, even in our process. But if you can sketch out a picture, sketch out a framework, show somebody, this is what I'm thinking, what do you think? Just like a napkin sketch, right? Mm-hmm. Napkin sketches. Dan Rome, a friend of ours, wrote a great book called Back of the Napkin. And it was so successful because it was that idea of, you know, writing an idea on the back of a napkin helps people see what you see. And that makes it also better. It makes it easier for them to critique what they see and give you feedback that's actually actionable or help you create something new.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. How long does that process take in a room full of people that can't draw?
I can't draw, Adam. Well, I shouldn't say that. Actually, my my creative team would kick me for that. Everyone can draw, right? We are all artists. We've been drawing pictures since we were young. I don't have the same talent that some of the incredibly talented designers at Explain have, but I think I'm a great person to walk into a room of other executives when they see me draw and I'm still doing it, they feel more confident. And so, you know, stick figures, frameworks, dots, it doesn't matter. The idea is to sketch your concept and try to make it as clear as possible. When you start sketching a strategic plan that's got 12 pillars, it looks like a snake pit because it has 12 pillars, right? You visually see, oh, we have to simplify this.
Yeah.
So you're really trying to get from complexity to simplicity, and drawing really actually accelerates that.
Yeah. And it removes, you could lose 3 hours if you're trying to get everybody to agree on a vision statement and they're debating over and or,
yeah,
or comma or semicolon. And there's nothing worse than that. There's literally nothing worse than that. It's the worst.
Yeah. I call it Frank envisioning.
Yeah.
You know, like you're putting a piece of this and a piece of that, and everybody ultimately feels ownership over a particular word. So it all being glommed together, but it doesn't really mean anything.
You think people do that? Like the CFO is going like, see that? That's the third word from the end. I did that. That's mine.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens. It's ugly.
Shareholder value. I added that.
Yeah.
I want to talk about a word that I think has become a little bit overused, but the way you explain it, the way you're using it is a little different. But the word is empathy. Mm-hmm. So it's taken on a life of its own over the past year and a half, in my very narrow view. But the empathy map that you create and this kind of Charlie Brown figure that's in the middle of it, mm-hmm, is really valuable because of the questions that you ask around it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could strike the word empathy. The map itself is looks like seven questions,
mm-hmm,
really brings logic to it and a framework that even just doing the empathy map, I could see for each department leader would be really, really valuable, probably annually, even if there's no change management.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, you know, it's interesting. The empathy map was developed at Explain by Dave Gray and Scott Matthews and a couple of other folks. And it's really become a great tool that a lot of people use in service and experience design. But I think the reason it's successful is that at the end of the day, what it's really doing is teaching us to think about the people in the process.
Yeah.
And that's the goal of it. It's to say a process isn't a bunch of boxes and lines and diamonds on a chart. A process is a human being connecting to another human being, connecting to another human being. And each one of those people have feelings and have thoughts and perspectives, right? And so the idea of the empathy map is, it's just to make us stop and pause and say, let me try to get inside your head. Let me try to understand what this person's going to think about this change and how that might impact them. And going around that exercise of saying, what are they thinking about it? What are they feeling about it? What are they not saying? What are the questions that they may have? Is a really great accelerant to understanding. And you can work in 1,000 ways. You mentioned, you know, you could just see is using the tool. I actually look at the empathy map before I even have a call with a client and try to understand, you know, what are they thinking right now and, mm-hmm, what are their concerns and what are their issues? And maybe I should prepare myself to address those in advance. So it really is it's a powerful tool to really start to anchor us in. There's a human being behind everything we do and we need to connect to them.
Do people, do you ever get pushback from people on trying to map this out just from a like inertia perspective of thinking through it, or do people intuitively get it?
You know, when we first introduced this exercise, it feels fluffy to people. And as soon as we're about 10 minutes into it, there's all these aha moments going off. And that's what's really powerful, because when people start to recognize that, oh, this person might be actually threatened by this change, and they hadn't thought about that, you know, it seems so obvious because I've done this so much. But oftentimes there's these epiphanies that come. And I know by and large the organizations where this has been introduced, it's stuck. People use it in lots of different ways. But at the end of the day, it's just the foundation of human-centered design. You know, it's the idea that we're designing solutions for humans, so we need to engage them in the process. And step one is to understand.
Let me ask you about an area that I've struggled in, which is governance. not the sexiest word in the world.
Yeah.
But dealing with, you know, big change management projects or org change projects, governance is always a thing where it's like, well, who has the authority to even decide those questions of, you know, how this rolls out or who does what? Where do you start when it comes to that? Like, in the framework of the work you do in your activation plan, do you talk about it sooner so that it can be addressed, or is it what's kind of in the nuts and bolts of activation?
We kind of talk about it philosophically as course correction. And so the idea we try to set up, in fact, I debated whether I was even going to include a section of governance in the book.
I'm so glad you did, though.
Yeah, it sounds kind of old timey and managed, you know, it's not.
Yeah, I know you refer to it as it may sound archaic, but I was like, no, I need exactly this page.
Well, and you know, the thing is that what we're trying to do is redefine governance to become iterative design, right? What we want to do is normalize the fact that, you know, we're going to make a plan and we're going to chart a course from point A to point B, and it's going to be a straight line on the chart. And when we're done with that course, it's not going to be a straight line. It's going to be a
very wavy.
You know, the wind's going to blow us offshore, and then we're going to get some wind in our sails. You know, and so no course ever looks like that straight line on the chart. Why don't we just accept that, right? Why do we have to say that this plan is rigid and it's fixed? And so the idea that we talk about in governance is just build a simple model that clarifies who has the authority to make course corrections. What are the signals that you're going to follow to learn when something's working or not working? And what's your process to actually make that course correction so you can keep it on track? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sounds obvious, but I can't tell you how often that doesn't happen, that maybe something's going off track and somebody's just been tasked to do a thing and no one has actually given them permission or empowerment to say, you can shift. No, if you learn something, you can do it differently. So we talk about it in the execution phase in the book. As one of the key things that we need to build in is that flexibility and that agility and that understanding that things are going to shift. We're going to get surprised. We're not going to anticipate everything. So let's make it part of our process to learn and iterate, sense, respond.
Why are we always surprised by that?
I don't know. I mean,
we got to change. I've been doing this a while. You would think by now I would know, but even I'm still surprised that I have to change course or adjust and I have to go ask permission. Like, oh, okay, I thought it was going to be X, but it's Y. So I need to do Z.
And then you multiply that by 10,000 empowered individuals who have agency in an organization, and you understand why it's hard to get things done.
Well, let me ask you this question, which is worse? If you get to that point at that inflection point and nobody's empowered to do anything, so the whole thing stalls, or everybody's empowered, so it moves exponentially in weird directions, but people trying to move it forward, which do you think is the bigger problem?
And that's $1 million question. I think the second one's the easier one to solve. I think if you have a culture in an organization that isn't empowered and can't make those decisions, isn't empowered to make decisions, you're never going to be able to respond quickly enough to change. If you at least have an organization where there is empowerment and people have the ability to make shifts, there's a couple of quick things you can do by clarifying who is accountable to making this decision, who's the person receiving the signal, and what's our process. And we can agree on a process up front in terms of how we're going to decide which change to make.
And how descriptive do you get with that governance, or even you refer to agility.
Yeah.
You know, is that through the design process with the team to figure out what their tolerance is and what the level of flexibility and sort of the skill at the decision-making level is?
Yeah, we quite literally, in fact, we built in the book a worksheet for exactly this problem where we get very specific. We put names on the page. Who is accountable for doing this? When are we going to meet? What is our agenda? What are the decisions that we can make versus the decisions we need to recommend? And we work with our teams before we launch an activation campaign to iron that out, because a lot of times it's just assumed that somebody's in charge. And the reality is that, we need to at least have one person who sees the breadth of what's going on and is at least empowered to say, we need to make a call here. So we build it right into the process.
That's awesome. Yeah. Someone is nominally in charge, but that takes me back to the other dog ear here on 64 about social movements. And so you can, like you said, an org isn't just boxes and lines, and you can technically have someone that is in charge, but when you get an organization that's at scale, it's thousands of people or even hundreds of people or sometimes dozens, It doesn't really work that way. Especially over the past 5 years, that top-down thing is really not, that's broken down quite a bit. And amen. But tell me about how you guys have studied social movements, and then, how that work applies to the process that you've been working.
Well, so one, I think a clarification you highlight, there's a big difference between in charge and accountable, right? Mm-hmm. And so one thing that this happened even in the session we were referring to yesterday, where at the end of the day, all these initiatives we were describing, the person that was written down as, accountable was the head of the department. And we know that senior leader is actually not in the day-to-day, doesn't have that visibility. Mm-hmm. So what we try to do is get it as close as possible to the source, right? So in a social movement, what's happening is we're really activating the grassroots, right? We're getting people on the ground to get aligned around a common purpose or a common vision and move forward together. A lot of our greatest social movements don't actually have a clear leader. We don't see that there's a hierarchical structure. Is there a clear leader to, you can think of two or three major social movements that we've experienced in the last many years, particularly on the social justice movement. There's not necessarily an infrastructure there. It's a, it's an idea. So you need to find those ideas. You need to find those things that are motivating. This is where that line of sight thing comes in as well, because you need to have everybody sort of see clearly where we're going and why. And then you need to identify for certain aspects of what's going on, who's accountable? Who's accountable to raise their hand and say, hey, we need to pivot? That accountability doesn't necessarily mean they've got the right to actually drive the entire organization in a new place. It does mean that they're part of the sensing mechanism, and they're raising their hand and they're talking to their peers and saying, I think we need to make a shift.
And you're baking that into the activation.
Yes.
That people know, like, oh, okay, I have that sensitivity. It's my job to be paying attention to those cues and calling out that I think we need to think about a new direction, or the plan needs to change because it's not getting us.
Yeah, I mean, the air traffic controller that's watching all of the planes flying around in the sky doesn't actually have the ability to shift those planes, but that person can see something before others do.
Yes.
And that's what we want to get. We want to get people to see things before others do and then share that information as quickly as they can.
Do you think, which is more compelling, and this may change over a time continuum, the current state or the problem we're running away from, or we're evolving away from, is probably a better way to say it, or the future state, this vision that we have, which is more compelling? Like, we have to move away from this that is going to be detrimental or is not our way to win, or like, we need to get to that mountaintop because that's our winning location.
Both are equally effective, to tell you the truth. In our experience,
I guess it's kind of like a carrot and stick thing. But
well, it's a balance, because ultimately, to get movement, there has to be enough of a compelling reason to shift, right? And so the compelling reason to shift might be that the current state sucks. We want to escape this and go to a better place.
Right.
The current,
exactly.
That might be, right? Like, I've been trying to get out of 2020 for 2 years.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, I work with a lot of organizations that are doing great work, and they're on top. And sometimes their biggest challenge is that because they're so successful, there's like no motivation to go to the next place. And so yes. then what has to happen is that that future vision has to be so exciting and compelling that it wakes people up and says, oh, we could do something even bigger. Right. Yeah. So it's about having enough momentum to generate a shift, whether it's because you're scaring me and I'm running away or it's something I want to run towards.
But if things are going well, it's more about figuring out how to convince them that they could be going even better.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there's organizations that we've worked with that, you know, that are, they're hitting their numbers, they're hitting their targets. They're really not motivated to make change. And, you know, this is even a place where in the engagement process of visioning, sometimes the reason that, strategy activation fails is because people don't actually see the reason to change. You know, mm-hmm. it's this exact case. Hey, we're on the top of our industry right now. And so there's an exercise that you know is required to either paint a really clear vision of a better future state that you could create, or start to be a futurist and start to anticipate where the future of the world is going to be and how you're going to need to evolve to that new place before your competitor in order for you to stay on top. And so we also try to bring a lot of visualization into this work for that reason. We might be spending time working with an organization to start to do some scenario planning. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens if this happens, this happens, this happens, 3, 5, 10 years from now? What should we do then? And by getting people into that imagination space, sometimes you can get them, you can shake them out of their current state enough to recognize, oh, we still need to be thinking about shifts in the future because that could happen. That possible future is out there.
And is that more external looking at suppliers or competitors or environmental shifts? Or is that more internal? Like, what if this person leaves, or what if demand stops for this product line? Or yes to all?
It's all the above. I mean, I'll give you a great example. At a smaller scale, we're working with a large nonprofit organization that's in Southern Oregon. And they're a performance-based organization. They bring people together for theater performances at a pretty large scale. In the strategic planning process with them, as we're talking about risk analysis and some of the challenges that they're having, one of the things that popped to the top was wildfire smoke. Mm. We're seeing so many fires because of climate change that it actually is starting to become dangerous in this particular region. And it's actually requiring them to shut down a lot of their performances. And so, you know, we're seeing risks or things that, you know, are emergent that sometimes were never in the business plan, but we need to actually sort of start to think about and anticipate these things. And they can actually, if we start thinking through the future, okay, what's this going to look like in the future? Is it going to get worse? In 5 years, are we in a completely different environment? Should we be shifting our entire program to digital platforms? Should we move?
Right.
Yeah. There's all these questions that come about as a result about thinking about possible futures. And so we're huge advocates for really getting people into some of those. You know, we talk about it in terms of elevation. So many meetings that we have with people are sort of at the ground level. They're talking about the weeds. They're talking about what they're feeling today. There's so much insight that comes from taking people up 200,000 feet, mm-hmm. facilitating a conversation where we give them permission to dream a little.
Yes.
And really imagine at a much higher level. And those imaginations can fill those scenarios in ways that really shift our thinking.
But remaining elastic so that you can get back down to the ground level once you've figured out, okay, oh, all right, here you arrive at the vision that we all agree on that is compelling. And then we need to get back to ground level to figure out how to activate it. Because that's where the slideshow lives, is up at that high level.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you need to give them the helicopter, right?
Yeah. You got to help them get up, but then you have to make sure they come back down with you to make sure it's going to get activated. Because
yeah, well, and that's where that connective tissue comes in the line of sight conversation we started with, right? That we need to understand that it's not sufficient just to have that high level picture.
Yeah,
we need to show the vision of where we're going. We also need to show the strategy of how we're going to get there, which is still a big picture, right? It's still our overall strategy is 1, 2, 3. Then we need to break that strategy down into a roadmap, because not everybody's going to take that entire journey. Maybe my department is going to touch segment one. And then we need to link that yet again to the role map, my individual role in this and my contribution. Only then does an individual have true line of sight of where they connect on the ground to that big picture in the sky.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm really glad I got to read this book. And Eric, I'm really glad I got a chance to talk to you about it. Thank you for making time. Where's the best place for people to order this? I'll link to it, obviously, in the show notes.
Oh, thanks. Well, you know, so you can get it at our website, explain.com, or you can get it from most book retailers, Amazon. It's distributed pretty broadly. So whether it's online with us or whether it's online with your favorite bookseller, hopefully you'll be able to find it.
Yeah, awesome. And where can people find you online for more conversation with you?
You can reach us through the Explain website, www.explain.com. And I'm also out there in the social. So find me on LinkedIn and I'd be happy to have a chat.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for making time. And I'm glad we were able to connect. And thank you for putting this book out there. It's amazing.
It's been an honor. Thanks, Adam. Really appreciate the conversation.
Strategy Inside Everything is produced by me, Adam Pierno. If you like what you've heard, leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Actually, I have no idea if that helps or if it's ever done anybody any good. If you really want to help the show and you like what you've heard, share it with someone else who you think will dig it. That's the best way to help the show and keep the conversation growing. If you have an idea, a question, or want to push back, go to thatsnotaninsight.com, where you can send me a message or leave me a voicemail that will be added to future shows. Music for the Strategy Inside Everything is by Saw Square Noise. For more information on me, you can go to adampierno.com to learn about my books, my speaking, and my consulting practice. Thanks for listening.